Welcome to Big Blend Radio with your hosts, Lisa and Nancy, editors of BigBlendMagazine.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Big Blend Radio's military show, where every first Monday we get to chat with military historian and author Mike Guardia. He's an award-winning author. He's got, is it 21 books now, Mike? 21?
Actually, it's 25.
25. I just think I'm still 21. That's what it is, you know? But military historian, U.S. Army veteran, and also named author of the year in 2021 by the Military Writers Society of America. And you may have seen him on the History Channel. Are you going to go back on the screen, Mike?
Yes, ma'am. So there is another show that's in the works. Now, there's very likely going to be a season two of I Was There. Cool. But just recently, I recorded some segments for an upcoming show on A&E called Military Mysteries. And as of this past spring, it was supposed to be in its final stages of post-production. So we're just going to see when the network puts it in the queue.
Very cool. It's exciting. I mean, when you were in the military in service, did you think like you would write 25 books and be on the History Channel?
Never in a million years.
Yeah. See, it's like, well, you put your mind towards something, right? And obviously, and on top of that, you're also a teacher and you educate, and you're always educating us. And today, I know we're going to be talking about D-Day again. D-Day is June 6th, everybody. Tuesday, June 6th, 1944. And we talk about the Normandy landings. And so before we get to, I know you're going to share a couple stories, which you do so well, about, you know, military heroes and telling us the human story of military and war. I do want to let people know that you've got two of your latest books out of the 25, are The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Frontlines of World War II. Good reading for D-Day. And also Coyote Recon, The Forgotten Wars of Colonel J.D. Vanderpool, who I just want to call him. He's a badass. Put a stamp on the front cover of the book, like, you know, Coyote Recon, the badass. But everyone, Mike's books are everywhere you can get books. And if they're not in your local bookstore, you should go talk to your bookstore people. You can also, of course, Amazon, all those great places, and bookshop.org, all those places. But you can also go to mikeguardia.com. Follow him on YouTube. He's always posting all kinds of things that are blowing up, but also showing the faces of war, people, what they're, you know, the soldiers and what they're going through, whether it's World War II in Vietnam or Vietnam. He's also on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram now too, which is awesome. Mm-hmm. So let's go to D-Day, because it's a term we all know. It's an event that we all know about, but maybe we don't. What happens, you know, you think you know, and if we haven't been in school for a while, we may have forgotten what D-Day is all about. So for those of us who need a quick history lesson on the Normandy landings, can you give us an overview of what happened that day?
Yes, ma'am. So let's wind the clocks back to the 6th of June in 1944. And this was a very critical part of the timeline of World War II, because we were planning an invasion of Europe. You know, this was the first time where American and Allied forces in mass were going to be penetrating the European continent, trying to get a toehold really on the continent to roll back the last of the Nazi war machine. And it was very important in the sense that, if this invasion failed, and if we failed to get a firm base of operations on the continent, then, you know, we could very easily have lost the momentum of the war, and it would have gone on for several years longer than what it ultimately did. You know, there was a lot that was riding on the success of this European invasion. And, you know, at the same time, you know, the Russians, for their part, they were heavily engaged on the Eastern Front, but, for as much headway as they were making against the Nazis in the East, you know, it's not really a well-known secret that Joseph Stalin was begging FDR to have the Allies open up a second front of the war because, you know, it got to a point where, you know, even the Russians were taking a tremendous beating, you know, trying to push back the Nazi war machine.
You know, so it goes back to FDR. Here we are again. I was just mentioning that before we got talking about it. Do you think that people, do you think he was forgotten about in World War II? You know, what he did, FDR?
Well, you know, I don't think he's necessarily forgotten. I think, you know, I think he just doesn't get a lot of the credit that other wartime presidents have gotten. You know, there was an exercise I was doing with my college students quite some time ago, and I was asking them, you know, this was actually a precursor to one of the lessons we were doing to study history at the turn of the century. And I was saying, okay, well, when you think of great US presidents, who comes to mind? And I'd give them 2 minutes or so to think of, you know, people who would fit the definition of a great US president. And then I had a lot of the students share their answers. And they all came up, now, slight variations in the names, but the top five generally included the following. You always saw Lincoln and Washington. Very often JFK was in there. Very often Teddy Roosevelt was in there. But almost all of them had FDR in there as well. And when I asked them to unpack, so when I asked them to unpack it and explain a lot of the reasons that they had for why they selected all of those individuals, when they defended the answer for FDR, they said, well, you know, his leadership in the context of the Great Depression and also during World War II. So that's what a lot of people tend to associate him with. But, you know, I don't think that if you take a look at American history as a survey, I think that most of the attention for World War II is given to the military commanders and not the wartime commander in chief, if that makes sense. I think more of the popular press is given to, well, hey, look what our military was doing after we came back strong after Pearl Harbor, and look at the landings in North Africa, and look at what Eisenhower and Patton and MacArthur and George Marshall were doing. So I think the popular focus tends to be on the military leaders and the military campaigns, and less press time is given to, well, hey, you know, this is what FDR was doing with the Wartime Production Board and how, you know, these decisions were made at places, you know, like the Malta Conference or whatever.
It's interesting you say all that because, you know, when you think about, you know, when we were talking the back when Steve Schnacker was on the show with you about celebrities and how there was like the propaganda desk or something like that. Like Ronald Reagan was doing that part, right? When you think about, like, it's almost like the communication. I don't know, maybe, do you think we have better communicate? Well, let's not get into politics, but do you think we have better communication now about what's happening in the world than at that time? Or like a president, it seems to me like FDR was running around and doing a whole bunch of stuff and it just was moving fast. Yet at the same time, for the troops out there actually fighting, you need to get stuff done. So it's kind of like two completely different games being played. And I don't mean that as a, you know, frivolous by the game, but it's like two different battles. Let's put it that way. One was like, how are we going to get things to people? But then once they're out there fighting, it's like we need to move and we don't really, you know what I mean? It's like two different things going on at the same time. But I don't think we got to know everything at that point as fast as what we can now find out what's going on.
You know? Right. So I think communication these days happens a lot quicker and there's a lot more real-time information that's passed. The trade-off for that I've seen, that I've noticed is that, well, yeah, we're quicker to get information, but because the information space has been so democratized to the point that anyone can weigh in with their own brand of information, it leads to an increase in misinformation. And there's a lot of rumors that circulate. There's a lot of biases and slanting that circulates as well. So I would say that the news is probably not as heavily vetted as it was back then. Because yeah, the information was slower to be published, but it went through, I think, a better vetting process, more of a fact-checking process. And, you know, the trade-off that you have now, at least what I've noticed, is that, yeah, stuff gets released and information gets put out there, but, you know, gosh, we all get information overload so quickly. And, you know, people are jumping to conclusions. They're making assumptions that somehow become gospel truths that months later we found out were really never valid to begin with.
Yeah, and maybe not put in context with the whole bigger scheme either, because it's like, oh, do you know, la, 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 la. But let's put all the puzzle pieces together. And I feel like that's what's kind of a problem, whereas, you know, during those days, they really did have this information desk. And, you know, and also then, you know, where are we getting our news from? That's kind of a problem we have now, too, you know, who's, you know, really, it's really difficult. I mean, nowadays, you can replicate people's voices through AI. Like, I wonder what's going to happen. That's a whole other discussion, Mike. AI in the military, like, whoa.
Oh, yeah.
That's some crazy stuff that can happen. But let's go back to the Normandy landings, because a lot of people died with this. It was on all sides, right? The Allied forces lost Germany, you know. So this was a very bloody event that happened, and something why we always look back to it, right? This is what changed the course of World War II, pretty much, this event.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Yeah. How many people? I was looking at this today and I was like, at least 10,000 for Allies. And then I was looking, 4,400 confirmed dead. Casualties were 10,000. But for German casualties, it from what I was reading, was like 4,000 to 9,000 people on the German side. So they don't really know. Like, that's weird. Like, what happens to people, maybe just out at sea and things like that, where you don't know?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of it boils down to, you know, people who are missing in action, and after a while they are declared dead in absentia. So, you know, there are a lot of people that really just never get recovered. And then casualty counts can also change from day to day. You know, sometimes you don't have a clear picture of who is actually a casualty and who isn't, or you have to just give your best guess estimate at one particular point in time on one particular day. And then you try to adjust that number later, like, okay, well, yeah, we had maybe 10 casualties in this one unit, but okay, it only turned out to be 7 because the guys who we thought were battlefield casualties, you know, it turned out that, you know, one just had heat exhaustion, the other one just, you know, got a really bad gash on his arm, but we patched him up and now he's back in the fight. So, you know, those casualty numbers can change from time to time. And then some units do underreport their casualty figures. They're like, okay, well, you know.
Oh, we don't want to look like, yeah. Oh.
Yeah. You know, and, you know, then other times when units are given their body counts of tallying up how many enemy soldiers they've killed, they inflate those body counts. So you're always going to get a ballpark number on either side, just really based on what the reports are saying in real time. And then you also, of course, have that X factor in there to say, okay, well, this person is officially labeled as missing in action. We don't know if they're dead or alive, but gosh, you know, it's been, you know, 30, 40 years since we've heard from this person. Let's presume that they're dead. But their status is always listed as officially being missing in action.
Wow. So when they landed, the Allies landed on the Normandy coast, and this is something I want to touch on, is that there were 5 different pieces of it, right? And I want to talk about the names, and I know we talked about this last year, but I still, you know, we like to name things around here, cars, you know, everything's got to be named. But I'm going to touch on those names. But when they landed, I mean, it wasn't like it was just a, it wasn't that sneak attack. People knew, and they were getting attacked, and there were, I mean, it wasn't like it was a soft, pretty beach. This isn't the Bahamas when they landed, right? There were things really making it hard for them to actually move in.
Yeah, it was. So, you know, it was no big secret, and Hitler and most of the German high command knew that an attack was coming, and they knew that the Allies were going to do one of two, or actually the Allies were going to do one of three things. They were going to invade Northern Europe, they were going to invade Southern Europe, or they were going to do both. And the Germans, for their part, said, okay, well, let's plan on them doing both, but if we had to gamble, let's say that the most likely course of action, the enemy's most probable course of action, would be to invade through the north, because that would give them the quickest thoroughfare across northern France and into the borders of the fatherland. So, you know, using what resources they had, and even, you know, organizing quite a few elements of the civilian militia, they, you know, put as much effort as they could into defending the parts of France where they had a heavy military presence. But they all knew that it was coming. And more to the point, they also knew that it was going to be a function of the tides. Because we see the popular images of D-Day, and we see the soldiers, we see them rushing the beaches at Normandy. And we see those little iron obstacles that are scattered along the beach, and they look almost out of place. They kind of look like these. They kind of look like these three-dimensional X-shaped figures. And the reason why they were there, they were actually put there initially as underwater obstacles to tear off the tracks and tear up the underbellies of the amphibious landing craft as they were making their way to the shore. But the tide went out right before D-Day, so the entire beach was at low tide, and that's why you see the soldiers weaving in and out between those iron obstacles. It's because because everything was in low tide, so they knew that they knew it was coming. They knew generally where it was going to be, and they had planned for it to be a true amphibious assault without much wiggle room between the end of the surf and the start of dry land proper. So it was no real big, it wasn't a question of when, but if, and they generally knew the area. So they just tried to make do the best they could.
And you had to move with the tides as well, right? And also you're open, when you're on a beach, you're like, it's open sesame, man. It's like, hello. Here I am, you know, there's no coconuts to, you know, hide behind, no giant coconuts, you know what I mean? It's not, that's, you're just, you're really in plain visibility. So that's a scary thing too. So there were the beaches, Utah, Gold, Juneau, Sword, and Omaha. Now, did the Americans do that? I'm just saying, who named those beaches?
So it's been a longstanding tradition in the U.S. Army, and I think for most of the Anglophone armies as well, that whenever you have an objective on a map or an objective that you're trying to reach, the high command will always give it a code name. And those aren't the only things that we have code names for. You know, we'll have names for objectives. We'll also have names for things called phase lines. So since operations are intended to happen in phases, like if you're making a land assault, you'll say, okay, well, when this particular company crosses phase line dog trot, this one platoon will break off and vector in this direction. And this other platoon will establish a base of fire. And then when that platoon gets to phase line hot potato, you know, we're going to have this particular
hot potato.
And they can be as colorful and as imaginative as whatever unit is put in charge of naming them, But yeah, you'll always have those seemingly out of place nicknames that will accompany either a control point on a map, a phase line, or an objective that you're trying to assault.
Wow. And so have you ever been there to Normandy?
Not yet.
On Normandy coast? Yeah, that would be interesting. If you go, we need to do like a live video thing, man, or something, podcast on that. Like that's like, I wonder, like, well, they've got to have the names up there, right? On the coast now to say, well, this is Utah. Mm-hmm. This is Omaha, Gold, Juneau, and Sword, right? Mm-hmm. And so people can identify those areas. I bet a lot of people go, not only just, you know, there's World War II buffs and, you know, enthusiasts, but there's families that must make pilgrimages there to know what their family went through, you know, their ancestors, you know, that they were there. Let's go to a couple of the stories that you have to share today, because you're good at that. And everyone, I'm going to say the Combat Diaries, go get that. That's a good reading for it too. And what I'm going to do is everyone, if you go to the show notes, I'm going to link last year's podcast with Mike on D-Day, where we talk about, we've talked about four people, I think we did, and Jim Carroll. There's a lot of different stories that Mike shared, so you can hear that too. So we'll have a double feature going on. But today I know you've got, let's start with my last namesake here, Bill Smith. Let's talk with him. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Hey, I could be related. You never know. Then you got to watch out, man. Sneak attack. No, so this is a huge deal.
Yeah, you know, so I will set the stage for Bill Smith. So Lieutenant William C. Smith, he was a guy who was like barely over 5'5" and maybe weighed 120 soaking wet. But despite his small stature and despite his very, very youthful appearance, I mean, this guy was just by every measure a badass. You know, he really was a product of his time. He was born in the early 20s, which means he came of age in the throes of the Great Depression. And, you know, despite having that rough and tumble upbringing during the Depression, he had actually made quite a reputation for himself and carved out an interesting niche at a surprisingly young age. When he was still in his teens, no less, he started a very successful insurance business. And this is kind of funny because you know, he was a teenager when he started the business, and the law was very weird. There was no technical statute for how young you had to be to start a business, but he had to wait until he was 18 before he was legally allowed to sell insurance. Okay.
Oh, that makes sense though. Yeah.
So, he just found a very clever way to work around it. Here he was, this young teenager, opened up his own insurance agency and hired full-grown adults to sell the insurance for him.
No way. That's 18. Cool.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking, man, that is what a way to think outside the box. And, you know, so of course, after D-Day happens, you know, he decides he wants to do his patriotic duty. And, you know, he ends up becoming an artillery officer. And specifically, the job he had as an artilleryman was as a forward observer. Now, in the world of artillery, being a forward observer, or an FO, as they like to call it, is really one of the most dangerous jobs you can have in the world of the field artillery, because you are essentially the liaison of death. You are right there on the front lines with whatever troop or whatever unit is in contact, and they can be in heavy contact, and you're on the radio trying to coordinate these artillery fires with pinpoint accuracy to a unit that's actively engaged in combat. And, you know, even the slightest miscalculation could bring that friendly fire on your own position instead of on the enemy. And, you know, the life expectancy for a young field observer, particularly in the European theater, was a little less than 10 months. But, you know, here we are in the summer of 1944, and Bill Smith has already far exceeded that hashtag or that hash mark for his life expectancy, because he had fought through the North African campaigns, and he had fought through a lot of the major campaigns that the 1st Infantry Division had been through at that point, and he was still alive to tell about it. So I said, okay, well, I made it this far. I'm probably going to, you know, survive the invasion of Europe. But, you know, the stakes were incredibly high because what he had done was found himself in a position where he would be part of the advanced team that was going ashore on Omaha Beach 2 hours before the actual invasion was to start. And there were only one of two ways for a forward observer to get to Omaha Beach. They had to accompany the Navy frogmen aboard these little tactical dinghies, you know, these tactical rubber boats, and swim ashore to disarm the enemy mines and the anti-ship barriers. And, you know, that was one way. Or he could go with the landing craft in the first wave of the invasion, where he might be among the 90% casualty rate that was anticipated for that first wave. Well, either way, the odds didn't really seem to be in his favor. And he said, okay, well, you know what? Let me go ahead of the invasion in the dead of night alongside these Navy frogmen. And, you know, I'll work my way, you know, into a place where there's good cover and concealment, and basically just hide myself under whatever I can find and try to register artillery fire onto the enemy positions as I see them, and, you know, try and soften up the German defenses as much as I can before the invasion actually starts. Well, you know, sounds simple enough in theory and concept, but, you know, he gets there and it is pitch black, it is the dead of night, and he's pretty much navigating by sound and by feeling the ground under him. So he's like, okay, well, I feel
sloshy. And you know, there's obstacles, right? There's obstacles on this beach, right?
Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's like, okay, so I feel sloshiness. That means I'm still in the surf. Okay, now I feel semi-firm ground, which means I'm probably in the sand. And if I try to interpret this from my map, okay, I feel that there's going to be a dip in the terrain right around here. And then he gets to a point where he's able to hide himself underneath a pile of rocks. And the only light that he's able to navigate is even able to keep any semblance of awareness of the time is the incandescent, the name escapes me right now and it shouldn't.
It was like a head thingy?
It was a glow in the dark surface of his watch.
And oh my gosh, no way.
Illuminescent.
That's the word.
Wow. It was that small glow in the dark piece that, you know, he was able to keep any bit of situational awareness. And, you know, then he gets on the radio, and then as the as the haze of the pre-dawn, you know, aura starts to settle over the landscape, you know, he's calling in battery fire, you know, from all the naval gunships that are miles offshore. And, you know, he starts calling in the first rounds of these artillery from the offshore batteries. And he says it's a spectacular show. But at the same time, as soon as the rounds started to fall in the German positions, the Germans turned on their searchlights and they started frantically crisscrossing the beach, because they knew that if they were getting artillery fire that was this accurate, there had to have been an Allied observer somewhere in the surf. Mm-hmm. So he said that was pretty scary because I knew that they were looking for me. And I was hidden well enough to where I was underneath this pile of rocks, and they just glazed over the rocks, not aware that here I was, this American forward observer who was calling in artillery fire.
That's crazy. Yeah. What did they use to be able to call that in? Like, and I mean, how far away were the, you know, like, how did that happen?
Yeah, so I mean,
it's not like he's talking to his watch now. You know what I mean? Like, kid, yeah. I need you. Yeah, mm-hmm. How did he do that?
Yeah, so there was a special radio system that he used, and it was kind of weird because one of his supervisors told him before he left, he said, look, whatever you do, take care of the radio. Make sure the radio doesn't get ruined, because a second lieutenant is expendable, but a radio is not.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
So
it's by radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so
it's like satellite.
He's using too. Well, if satellites were around back then, yeah. But he's using this very specialized radio set. And so he's in contact with the offshore batteries through that. And yeah, he's calling in this fire and he's like, okay, well, you know, that first round fell a little short. I want you to raise it, you know, by 3 mils. And then I want you to push it, you know, 4 mils to the left. And, you know, he's able to, he's able to call in a lot of this accurate fire. But he said, you know, even still, there was no way that I could register fire to the point where it would save, you know, as many lives as I wanted to, because he remembers after the first wave of the invasion was over, and after, you know, the last of the guns had been silenced on the German side, and he said, you know, after so many hours of sitting underneath that rock pile, and he said, you know, I finally emerged and I could see all of the dead bodies of all of our troops that were floating in the surf. And I'm just thinking, my God, you know, so many of these guys who got hit in the first wave, you know, I can't help but feel a little bit of survivor's guilt, because, mm-hmm. you know, I figured that, okay, well, why me and not them? And not only that, it's just, my gosh, you know, for as much fire as I was calling in on the German positions, it weighs heavily on my soul that, you know, even that wasn't enough to save, you know, these hundreds of poor fallen troops that I see lined across the beach.
Mm. Well, that's sad. It's sad. Mm-hmm. And when you talk about frogmen, those are like divers, right? They're like,
yes,
mm-hmm. combat divers. So like if they see Correct. You and you're on the other side, they're going to kill you in the water.
Right.
They're going to get you mm-hmm. and feed you yeah. to the sharks. Okay. So then that's brutal, man. that's, and you, again, think about back then, right? And if mm-hmm. it's at night, would they dive at night? I mean, they had to at times, right?
Oh yeah. Be able yeah.
to, that's mm-hmm. creepy, Mike. That's creepy.
It
like
is.
Think about yeah. it. It's like you know what it's like. I remember once swimming at night out in the coast in California. It was like late night and we were all just having fun, you know, just, you know, young kids being stupid. And you know, you feel that little bit of seaweed on your leg and you're like, mm-hmm. What is that? Like, is that a, you know what I mean? I don't know. Right. Maybe it's just from being in South Africa with great whites, you know, that's a little mm-hmm. different, but whenever you feel something, you know, you could go down. And then if it's human, that's freaky at night, but I want to go back to the satellite dish. So get me straight on this. So this was okay. radio communication. When did satellite yeah. come in being used in the military?
All right. So satellite comms, you know, that's really right after the space age, you know, I mean, like the birth of NASA, okay. you know, when we were launching stuff into orbit. So, yeah, okay. But all the satellite communications, especially the ones that at least we had back in the 20 teens when I was still in the service, you know, they are some top notch equipment, man. They you talk about instant communication from one side of the planet to another in real time and, you know, clear as day. And, you know, things that are so well encrypted that, you know, it can't be hacked by any of the enemy's signal intelligence operations.
You know, we should really talk about this kind of thing on another show, like these kind of things, like satellite and radio and even the internet, because the internet came from the military. And we mm-hmm. forget that. Google did not invent the internet. I just want You're people right. to know. Does anybody remember pre-Google? I do, because we, you know, we were on it working, you know, putting websites up and stuff pre-Google, you know, mm-hmm. and even in our print magazine, we were trying to get people to promote their website because they'd go spend thousands of dollars on a website. Remember way back when. And, mm-hmm. you know, and then like they wouldn't promote it anywhere. And there was no, you know, we used to get these giant Earthlink books and stuff, you know.
Yeah.
And now I'm really dating myself, but it's true. It happened, people. But we should do mm-hmm. a show on communications and the internet and satellite and all of that, because even just how fighter pilots talk to each other to me is amazing. Like I get it, still is. Like even if you think about how we're even doing this podcast, right? How cell phones, yeah. how we can talk through cell phones. It's pretty mind-blowing. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. what we've done in technology. Then we go right. back to World War II and it's like, dude, watch out, there's stuff on the beach that you don't want to touch, you don't want to step on it, mm-hmm. you know. And this goes beyond the jellyfish, right? So right. that was Bill Smith, Lieutenant William C. Smith, man. Wow. Mm-hmm. That's kind of, do you think it's like weirder when you're on your own too? Like you're on your own, even though you're a team and you're, you know, group of, you know, soldiers together, that's kind of freaky in that you're on your own. Like right. that, I think there's something to that to look at too, getting out there. And what about that you're in a different country?
Right.
You know, that's the other thing I think is, you know, the different countries. You're just, it's different. So Tom Stafford.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I love the Stafford name. You know why, Mike? This is important.
What's that?
It's called Ooey Gooey Bars.
Okay.
In Porterville, California, there's, and they're now grown as a family. It's a family, Stafford's Chocolates. They make Ooey Gooey Bars, and you can go watch them make all these different chocolates, and they are absolutely, hands down, some of the best chocolates and naughty things to eat on the planet. So when I saw Tom Stafford, I'm like, I wonder if they're related. You never know, right? You never know. But like chocolate. But anyway, that's not what we're here to talk about, chocolate. But my mind went there immediately. I was like, I want an Ooey Gooey Bar. They're delicious. They come in a big stick. Oh, yeah. It's, yeah. Do you like s'mores?
Yeah.
Like, kind of think of that. And then like, oh, dude, like that's some serious good stuff. Okay, so tell us about Tom Stafford, because this guy kind of reminds me of the story of Lee Marvin in a way of like how he can just do anything, right? Uh-huh. He's like a superhero.
Yeah. Yeah, he really was a jack of all trades. So Tom Stafford, I guess in a lot of ways, his upbringing reflects that of Bill Smith. And, you know, here with Tom Stafford, you had a, you know, you had a guy who grew up in the throes of the Great Depression. And unlike Smith, however, Tom Stafford, he remembered the New Deal as a defining aspect of his upbringing. And you know, he was even one to, you know, have real-time knowledge of all of these, you know, alphabet soup programs of the New Deal, you know, like the CCC, the TVA, the WPA, and whatnot. But you know, he recalled that at times, you know, I mean, even though he appreciated the logic behind wanting to get the country back to work, he said, you know, a lot of these New Deal programs really looked like make work projects. You know, you would have somebody working on like a landscaping project for like the CCC. And, you know, it would be a project where you would see two guys actually doing the work. Two other guys were sitting around doing nothing. And one guy was just standing off in a corner. And it turned out that the one guy off in the corner was the supervisor, quote unquote. And his job was really just to supervise. I mean, whatever that meant. But it was clearly a job that could be very well accomplished by only two people, you know?
Hmm.
So, you know, he, so what he ended up doing was he joined the military. He was actually drafted out of the College ROTC program. And at first, you know, here was the start of a very interesting military career for him, because he had a number of different MOSs, you know, that is the military occupational specialties. And he, at first he was designated to be a supply specialist. And, you know, in military parlance, that would make him a quartermaster. So, you know, he was, going to the quartermaster center, but then he was told he was too young to lead troops in the quartermaster corps. So they sent him to a non-commissioned officer school, where in as little as 90 days, a high-performing soldier could earn his stripes as a technical sergeant. And you know, so he eventually goes from the U.S. He deploys to England, you know, as part of the buildup to the Normandy invasion. And you know, he lands in one of the many replacement depots that are over there. And he's getting ready for, you know, he's getting ready for the invasion of Europe. But, you know, then he decides, well, you know what, being a quartermaster is all fine and good, but is there something else that I could do that would be more, more akin to the abilities I know I have, and something that dovetails more into what I want to do as a soldier? So that's when he sees, that's when he sees an ad at the local camp that he's at, asking for volunteers for the 6th Combat Engineer Amphibious Special Assault Brigade. Oh. I know that that's a mouthful, but it was this, super secret squirrel of a combat engineer unit, and they were looking for volunteers. Now, Tom would have been the first to tell you that he knew nothing about being a combat engineer, and they weren't specifically looking for people who had any engineering or any type of tactical mine emplacement or obstacle experience. They really just wanted people who were eager to learn something on the job. So he said, hey, you know what, that sounds great, and he volunteers for it. And yeah, that's how he ends up deploying to the coast of Normandy. But he said it was an adventure in and of itself, because we were supposed to land at Omaha, he said, but on the 6th of June, they were taking such heavy enemy fire that that their landing craft said, hey, screw this, the landing zone's too hot. I'm going to find you an alternate landing zone miles upshore. So they end up quite a ways away from where they were supposed to be. And, then essentially he gets off of the, he gets off the landing craft, and they're trying to find, the rest of the Allied bodies. And, they're marching over some fallen comrades. And one particular incident that stood out in his mind was that, he noticed that among all the dead GIs that, he and his friends were trying to make their way around and trying to step over as they were getting to the rendezvous point. He said, I noticed one of them distinctively was an Army Ranger captain. And he says, that surprised me, because the Rangers were supposed to be landing at Point Du Hoc, and I couldn't figure out why they were in this particular place that we had landed down at Verville-sur-Mer. So he always said that that was something that he never quite understood. But, he finally fights his way through Normandy. And then finally, after the initial fury dies down of that invasion, he takes an interesting detour, because as a reward of sorts for surviving the D-Day invasion, Tom and a few of his fellow soldiers in this crack unit were reassigned to POW guard duty. They were guarding these German prisoners, and it wasn't necessarily an unpleasant experience, but it was something that he grew very tired of very quickly, because he said, hey, essentially what I'm doing is I am babysitting a bunch of indignant Nazis. And he said, I got fed up with that. And I was like, hey, I either want to go back to a regular unit, my old unit, or just put me in the replacement network. And that's exactly what they did. They said, okay, well, if you don't want to guard these POWs, I'm just going to send you to another replacement center, and you're going to be reassigned probably as a regular rifleman. And it's like, well, that's okay by me. So now he gets the third combat reassignment of his so far brief career. He's gone from being a quartermaster to being a combat engineer to being a rifleman rank and file in the 87th Infantry Division. And
he gets bored quickly, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does. So, they had been, and at this time, the 87th Division had been pulled from Metz, and they had been reattached to the Third Army for the relief of the beleaguered troops at Bastogne. This was during the Battle of the Bulge. Mm-hmm. And, so he spends most of the winter there, fighting through the Bulge, trying to break out of, really trying to break out of Bastogne. And he has quite a few, interesting experiences there on that front, because now as an infantryman, he's having more run-ins with some of the local Germans. And it was at one point, there were two Germans who he captured that were overlooking a redoubt that was at the Marksburg Castle. And he moves a little bit further into a town called Bad Ems, and that's where he ended up capturing, of all people, a German general. And yeah, it was a stroke of good luck, because, you know, it's not every day that an American GI is going to capture a high ranking Nazi general. But this general was dressed in his civilian. He was at first dressed in his civilian clothes. And he gave no indication that he was a high ranking officer in the Wehrmacht. And he probably would have escaped detection. But, as Tom was searching the guy's home, he found the general's uniform in the closet, and he's like, "Oh, hey, what's this?" And then, you know, the general finally admitted, "Okay, well, yes, that is my uniform." Yeah, but
this guy is a badass. I mean, it is. Uh-huh. It's like, so he almost becomes a sniper / detective. Like, uh-huh. And do you think when he was watching over the POWs that he got some from, like, he started to learn? He observed right then,
right,
and what was going on, so that probably mm-hmm. helped too. But it's stroke of luck. But right. I think luck. There, I don't believe in luck. I believe it's he understood the opportunity, right?
Right.
It's not just a stroke of luck. Yeah.
When good preparation and hard work meet luck, I think that's when everything works out.
Yeah, there's that saying. Yeah, that's exactly mm-hmm. what I mean. It's like you've been prepared, you've been observant, but he seems mm-hmm. to be kind of a live wire dude that just he's wants to move on, have different experiences. And he's just mm-hmm. like, hey, he's treating it like a little roller coaster game.
Yeah.
Wow. So he gets his dude. This is crazy. Mm-hmm. So what happens from there? Do they promote him?
Well, yeah, he actually gets a battlefield promotion at some point, and they even try to make an officer out of him. But he's like, you know what? That would just take me away from the men who I have grown very close to. And, as time goes on, you know, he realizes, hey, you know what? I don't think that there's anything else that I would rather do besides lead troops. And, you know, and reluctantly, he finally accepts a battlefield commission, you know, and they say, okay, well, you know, you've been here with the unit long enough, so we're going to give you a battlefield commission. And, you know, as I said, he didn't want to take it at first because he didn't want to leave his troops, but he ultimately accepted it. Though the process of getting it was kind of morbid, because to earn a battlefield commission, the existing lieutenant had to have been killed in action or permanently evacuated from the battlefield. And, you know, if you get the battlefield commission, that means you're the next ranking sergeant in line. And they said, okay, well, Sergeant, you know, so-and-so, you are now Lieutenant so-and-so. So take what's left of your platoon and try to accomplish the mission and not get killed, so the next guy behind you in rank won't have to take over.
Wow. Oh, wow, mm-hmm. wow. Wow, that's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
God, how do you find these people?
they're the everyday heroes that really live amongst us, and it really is a testament to, you know, what seemingly normal people can accomplish when the chips are down, mm-hmm. and you really dig deep and you pull off miracles that nobody thought were even possible.
Yeah.
And so after he accepted that battlefield commission, you know, he said, okay, well, you know, I think I'm going to stay in for a while. And he stayed in through the armistice, was thinking he was going to deploy to the Pacific, but he ended up not, you know, they dropped the bomb, and that ended that theater of the war. So he stayed on occupation duty for quite a while, and, you know, ended up serving in the Cold War in Europe. And then,
wow.
And then after that, even did a stint in Korea.
Wow.
And it finally closed out his career in 1963 as a budget officer in the office of the controller of the Military District of Washington. So, you know, here was a guy who made it a career, more than 20 years of active service. And yeah, said, huh, okay, well, you know,
that was a fun ride, and it was a career that I never really counted on having.
Well, I think he, you know, there's I don't know how to explain it. There's an adrenaline thing that happens in danger. And I think it's an addiction in a way, you know, you can get addicted to that. And I don't mean this in a bad, negative way, but you know, when on a easy way, like if you're on a road trip and nothing goes wrong, that's a boring road trip. You know what I mean? Now I should never have said that. I'll probably get a flat tire with all the potholes we have across the country. Please don't protect the car. She doesn't want it. But you know what I mean? It's like there's something about living on the edge that way and having to be so observant, aware, and it's so real and raw that there's certain personalities that it just really is a big match for. And I get it. I totally get that personality of being on the edge that way, because it is about not being shackled to regular life. And I think there's people that are 100% suited towards it. And he obviously was, you know, until he became like the budget dude. Then they put him in an office, didn't he? And he probably didn't like that. I have a feeling he didn't like the office stuff. That's gonna suck.
Yeah, it wasn't what he naturally gravitated towards, but you know, he did it the best he could.
Yeah. I mean, and you get to a point where you still want to have your foot in there, but yeah, you know, it's like musicians eventually go, okay, I'm not touring anymore. I can't, you know, Willie Nelson's still going though, for some reason. Yeah. I think he smoked himself out. Like he's like, I don't know, you know, it's like he smoked me. I don't know, but he's still going, but you know what I mean? There's that, that personality that's like, oh, it's an adventure almost, even though it's brutal. And I'm not trying to romanticize it,
right?
But there's personalities that have that, like, you know, I'm going in, you know, and power to him, man. And for all of us, you know, for what he's done in his career, that's amazing. Amazing stories. What is coming up next? So people can have book number 26 on the horizon.
All righty. Well, I'll give you a little bit of a preview. Actually, two previews. See? One is called Fire in the Hole, and that is a story about the combat engineers in Vietnam. And then let's see, after that, we have a book called Sarajevo at Dawn, and that is talking about the spy war in Bosnia during the NATO peacekeeping mission that kicked off during the mid-90s.
I remember that.
Yeah.
I remember that. So that's the next one. So when do we think, when does the Fire in the Hole come out?
So Fire in the Hole is going to be this year. And then Sarajevo at Dawn is going to be the following year.
Okay. Well, you're busy, Mike. You're busy.
Yes, ma'am.
I know. It's fantastic, though. I love that you're telling the stories. Are these books going to have, you know, the soldier stories like you do?
With,
I mean, even whenever you do, like even the F-14 and stuff. Yeah. We were talking about you with some friends the other night because he did designs, engineering for some fighter jets. And I had to go and show him your books because I didn't know what I was talking about. You know what I mean? It's like different names or whatever. You know what I mean? It's names and numbers that I don't understand. He's an engineer, and that's way, way beyond my paycheck. So anyway, I just I go, this is what I'm talking about. He goes, no, this is a different era. Anyway, so very good stuff. And listen, I love that about, you know, learning about jets and all of that, because they have stories too, you know. I mean, to me, I had no idea. You're the one who taught me, like, oh yeah, we could build this and build that, and then we'll send it over and sell it over to another country, and then they'll use it against us later. It's like, can happen. So very good, very good. Everyone, MikeGuardia.com is the website to go to. And again, the latest two books, The Combat Diaries, True Stories from the Front Lines of World War II. And you've got to get Coyote Recon, The Forgotten Wars of Colonel J.D. Vanderpool. he knows about the Pacific Theater for sure. Mm-hmm. Big time. Kaboom. That's what I'm going to say. Yep. Keep up with Mike. He is here every first Monday on Big Blend Radio, and you can keep up with us at bigblendradio.com. Again, the show notes that I was telling you about will be in the show notes. The links over to his previous interview on World War II's the D-Day. So thank you so much, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lisa. Always a pleasure to be on the show.